Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. According to Christian doctrine, one of the promises of salvation through Christ is eternal life in heaven. But for pagans like me, and even for many Christians, we'd be a lot happier with the secular method of living a really long time on earth. Enter today's guest, Mike Perry, who's devoted himself to making the promise of eternal life a scientific reality as a philosopher, as a practical career, and as a spiritual path. Stay tuned for our chat. I'm speaking today with Mike Perry. Mike Perry is a PhD in computer science who lives in Scottsdale, Arizona, but is no longer, to my knowledge, pursuing a career in computer science because he is the patient care assistant for the Alcor Foundation, which freezes people for future reanimation, and the president of a new religious organization called Society for Universal Immortalism, and the author of the book Forever for All, Moral Philosophy, Cryonics, and the Scientific Prospects for Immortality. I wonder, and I'm sure many of the listeners wonder, how you got interested in cryonics. It's been such a controversial and considered fringe topic for many people. But so when did you first get exposed to the idea of freezing and reanimation, and how did it become attractive to you?
I'd have to go all the way back to grade school, maybe about third grade or so. I used to watch a show called Science Fiction Theater. It was hosted by a man named Truman Bradley, and one of those episodes was about the idea, well, what they showed, these shows were science fiction, little science fiction stories, but they always were based on some kind of process or possibility that had been partially realized in the real world. And what they showed on this one episode was that this fish could be encased in a block of ice, apparently just frozen solid, and you could thaw it out and it would swim away, be alive. And they developed that into a little story about finding a baby mammoth in ice and reviving it. And that had a, you know, it started a train of thought in my mind. And other influences also were important to me. I was always concerned about the problem of death and how you might deal with it. And I had a fairly traditional religious upbringing in which this problem was, it was said that it would be dealt with by a supernatural means, and that satisfied me for a while, but eventually it didn't, and I had increasing doubts about the existence of any such supernatural process or power. And I also read, I was interested in science fiction from an early age, reading it as well as watching shows. And when I was about 12, I remember reading a story by A.E. Van Vogt called Resurrection, in which advanced technology is used by some alien visitors to planet Earth. They find that the human race has died out, but there's a lot of remains, human remains still present, and they have some sort of technological means to bring people back. And that suggested to me that, well, maybe there is a way to do those things, and therefore it would be a scientific problem, not a problem where you have to depend on some incomprehensible process to solve it for you.
So it's been a very common idea in science fiction. I remember in 2001, A Space Odyssey, Arthur C. Clarke had projected that we would be using, by the year 2001, cryonics in order to get out to get our astronauts out to places like Jupiter.
Yes, that's right. And, well, you just have to, there is such a thing as cryonics, but it's not being used that way yet. So the pace of progress is not always as fast as you project it to be.
Now, you got involved with the Alcor Foundation when?
That was in the mid-1980s, maybe about 83 or 84. And I had already had some exposure to cryonics, but I liked Alcor's policies, and they seemed to be, at this time, in the early 80s anyway, there had been some problems with other cryonics organizations that didn't survive very long because of things like inadequate funding, inadequate commitment by certain people who were trying to maintain people in cryonic suspension. And so there had been some suspension failures, and there was quite a bit of worry about whether you would really stay frozen once you got frozen. And there was good reason to worry like that, since so many had not been. And so Alcor, the people in Alcor were really concerned about this problem, and that's what attracted me to Alcor, I think, their rational approach, among which was that the idea that preserving the head only really should be enough to preserve the entire person, because in the future, if we develop the technology to get the brain functioning again, it should be possible also to recreate a body. Recreating a body, I think, would be easier than reanimating the brain, which is such a delicate organ.
Yeah, this has been a point of controversy, I guess, between different cryonics organizations.
It has. That's right.
The notion that that just cutting off the head and freezing it in a giant Dewar should be enough, which I think I agree with you. You know, if you have the technology to repair what's inside that frozen head, you probably don't need anything more than the head. But other organizations think that it presents an aesthetic and marketing challenge, right? That's the principle.
That's correct, and I'm not challenging what they say. I'm sure it does present a marketing challenge, so I'll just leave it at that. But I was attracted because I was one of those people very concerned about the possibility of suspension failures, which often happen because of inadequate funding, and it's easier to maintain the neuro or head only than the whole body. So that was one of the things that drew me to Alcor. It was the way that the people in Alcor approached this issue was a hard-headed, rational choice to be made. You're trying to preserve what's really important.
Now, it seems in my understanding of the history, I wasn't really that connected with the organizations or individuals in the 80s, but looking back, it seems like the publication of Engines of Creation by Eric Drexler was really a watershed event for cryo, because Eric was not only a member of Alcor, but also spoke explicitly about how nanotechnology, future nanorobotics, might be used to actually provide what had just been a matter of faith for most people in cryo up to that point. Do you see it the same way, that it was really...
More or less. Actually, he wasn't a member of Alcor when he published Engines of Creation. He became that later. But it did add credibility. It suggested a possible scientific mechanism with some amount of detail for doing all the things that we know we're going to have to do. Before that, people would talk about just how complicated the brain is and ask, how in the world are you going to deal with all those billions of cells and everything that might need to be repaired individually. And this suggested a possible way to do that. So I think it did give cryonics a much better image among certain thinking people anyway.
Well, this is something I understand that you address in your book, where you go into some of the scientific argumentation for why it should be eventually possible to put back together, I guess, as it's been famously said, turning the brain into hamburger is a part of this freezing process, and you can't turn hamburger back into a cow, somebody quipped once. But
I like that quote, because I can tell you how to turn hamburger back into a cow. With one word, it's called cloning. You take one cell of that hamburger, and you can make a cow out of it that's pretty close to the original. If you really wanted to go further, I suppose you could train your cow and everything. It would be almost the same cow all over again, and you can come pretty close to really doing it. And but we want to do more than that with people, of course. We don't want to just produce a clone. We want to have the original memories and everything.
Well, this has been the key issue, is how much of the original personality, given that we might be able to put together some of the brain, how much from kickstarting this reconstituted brain, how much of the personality and memories would we ever be able to recapture? And
that's a very good question to raise. And
you take a strong optimist point of view on that.
I take an optimistic point of view, but it should be understood that I have certain ideas about what you might call recreating the original person, which I think the doorway is even open when information is lost for recreating the original person by guesswork. But it's the argument is a somewhat far-fetched argument that invokes the multiverse concept and the idea that guesswork will grab something out of a parallel time stream that you can consider to be an authentic version of the person that you have created. And anyway, it's a difficult thing to go into in a word or two. I think the best advice I can give the curious at this point is you can look further into that matter. You can contact me or read my book or whatever. It is an optimistic point of view. However, to realize the possibility would not be very easy. It might take many centuries to go the full distance. And I do feel that cryonics offers some advantages, and even if there might be other ways to recover a person or recreate the person, I would advocate a preservation option to deal with clinical death rather than what the alternatives are, cremation or burial.
I'm speaking with Mike Perry. He's a PhD in computer science, lives in Scottsdale, Arizona, author of the book Forever for All, Moral Philosophy, Cryonics, and the Scientific Prospects for Immortality. He's also the Alcor Patient Care Assistant for the Alcor Foundation, which freezes and hopes to eventually reanimate people. And we also want to talk about the fact that he's the newly elected president of the Society for Universal Immortalism. And I want to just point out that we spoke last week to Dr. David Pauls, who's a surgeon in Kansas City, who is a Christian bioethicist. And he had recently written that transhumanism is a form of Gnosticism. He thought that we were the reincarnation, basically, of ancient Gnostic heresies that attempt to separate the self from the body, that look upon the body with disgust. And I'm sure that he would put in that category the notion that you could cut off your head and freeze it and eventually extract personality from it and have a new, better life in the future. I suspect that he would consider that to be part of his Gnostic heresy. Now, so let's talk about the Society for Universal Immortalism, because you're trying to put into a religious or spiritual context, albeit an atheistic spirituality, the idea of a social commitment to general defeat of death. I have that right?
Sure, that's correct. Let me make a remark about religion to start with. This is my point of view anyway. A religion is a body of beliefs, attitudes, and practices whose intended purpose is a beneficial engagement with what can be reasonably regarded as having transcendent or ultimate significance. I realize that's a mouthful, but I wanted to state it carefully, which is necessary here. And anyhow, I don't feel that religion has to involve a belief in the supernatural. It can, and it very often does, but you're trying to deal with things that are of the greatest significance in life. And so you use whatever tools are available, whatever seems reasonable or meaningful, whatever you can put your trust in. And many people do feel that they have to put their trust in something supernatural, but I think the possibilities exist for other ways of dealing with the deep problems of life. And it is possible to develop a religious feeling without invoking the supernatural. So that brings up possibilities such as transhumanism, which is the idea of developing beyond the human level and dealing with the problem of transcendence, of trying to overcome death in particular through scientific means. The developments in science have raised that possibility, which didn't used to exist. So that can explain some of these movements or attitudes that you're now seeing, that there you can actually develop a religious perspective on things that doesn't require a belief in something beyond our scientific understanding or beyond any level that we could ever have.
One of the reasons that people of faith often have a problem with the notion of a transhumanist transformation of the body or the transmigration of personality from one body to another is the notion, their notion of soul. And one of the key tenets and beliefs of this, of your society for universal immortalism, is the postulate that the soul is in fact informational, which I, you know, for me, coming out of a Buddhist background, that's very consonant with the Buddhist understanding of self, which is, you know, Buddhism developed out of a rejection of the notion that there's an eternal spiritual self and argued instead for an informational self.
That's correct. We feel that the soul is informational in nature. If you want to call it a soul, by, you know, consider the soul to be the center of our being, the essence of who we are. By the way, I'm quoting from the beliefs of the Society for Universal Immortalism that were mainly formulated by Tripper McCarthy. I'll give him credit for this, and he did a good job. I should also say that this informational point of view is controversial, even in the cryonics movement. Not everybody goes along with it, but certainly there many of us do. I think really it might be correct to say that a minority of cryonicists are willing to go the full distance with this, but in our universal immortalist movement, that is the position we take.
What's the principal alternative, philosophical alternative to that?
Well, the alternative is the idea that the body is important and physical continuity is important. It often is expressed with the idea that, you know, the original body was what has the person in it, and if you made a duplicate, that can't be the original, and you can't say that the duplicate is you in the same sense that the original is you. Whereas the informational alternative would be that if you have a well enough made copy, that you just have to take the position that the soul can fission into two or more individuals that have to be considered on an equal footing. And some of us don't have any problem with that. I don't myself, and others do.
Another part of the passages in the beliefs that you've codified that I was very struck by is that you argue that you believe in a free flow of information ideas and a direct participatory democracy in which all have an equal voice. And you know, I was raised in the Unitarian Universalist denomination and continue to participate in my local Unitarian church. And one of the seven principles of Unitarianism is a belief in the importance of democracy. Not very many, I think you'll probably agree with me, that not very many transhumanists, many of whom have a libertarian or market anarchist orientation, not very many would have put this notion of direct participatory democracy in their codified statement of belief.
Yes, and I'll confess something, that I'm one of those people. I was skeptical about the idea of having a full democracy because, it seemed like, you know, it could lead to certain things like if you had that in a cryonics organization, you might end up with a bunch of people that realize that this organization's got a lot of assets and they would like to get their hands on it, so they all sign up as members and they vote it out of existence. In effect, they would vote to award these assets to themselves, and they would constitute a majority, and you know, maybe it wouldn't even be a cryonics organization anymore. But I'll give credit to the person that started the Universal Immortalist organization under another name. His name is David Croft, and he is the great champion of democracy in the Society for Universal Immortalism. His organization originally was called the Transhumanist Church, and the name was changed last year to what it now is, but he has vigorously upheld the principle of democracy and convinced me that it could be made to work. You need to have a Bill of Rights to make sure that you don't just have a mob rule. So far, our organization is so small that it has worked very well and there's no problem. What will happen if we should grow to a very large size, I'm not sure, but maybe with modern electronic means, we can continue to be this full democracy. We can use email to vote, and we'll just have to see how it turns out. But I like the idea of democracy, too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, one person, one vote sounds right to me, too, in a way. So you have to manage it, and that's what we're trying to do.
The other aspect about putting this in the context of a church is that you make clear in your statement of belief that we have, that society has a goal, that your organization is committed to the general goal of ensuring that all people can be free from involuntary death.
Right.
And I think that that's also an interesting philosophical point of view, because many transhumanists argue for people's right to have to be free from not having access to those technologies, but few would argue that we have a general commitment to ensure that everyone have them. It's a very different thing. The right to and the right from, as some people put it.
Yeah, I'm not. I hope I understand you correctly. I think, in general, the transhumanists are going to say that people have the right to any technology that could reasonably better themselves. They should not be subject to involuntary death. That's an outrage to us, you know, a form of execution. But we also respect the right of people to make choices uncoerced, even if they did choose to die. We can't just say that they should be coerced against that. So what we are opposed to is the idea that a person should not have the right to choose to extend their life. And there seem to be some people that feel that death is such an important part of being human that maybe you should consider restricting the right, if you did have the means, to radically extend your life and maybe become something other than an ordinary human being. They seem to be saying that we ought to consider whether there should be some restraints on that. And I think that's where you find a transhumanist to be opposed to any idea of putting restraints on an individual making decisions about improving their own life as they would judge the matter, as long as they are willing to reciprocate and allow others to make choices too, uncoerced.
Well, I think one of the places where a difference in emphasis might come out is brought out by the set of stories that Frederick Pohl wrote in Tales of the City. I don't know if you ever saw that, but Fred Pohl being one of the classic science fiction writers, and he, in his novel that he wrote in the 1970s, he proposed that sometime in this century, everyone on their deathbed could be given some options about whether they wanted to die an ordinary death and be cremated, or whether they wanted to be frozen, or whether they wanted to go through, some kind of palliative care. And now that we're facing this huge debate over the future of Medicare and Social Security and things like that, it seems like there you could offer to people a relatively cost-effective way of preventing all the long-term costs associated with the treatment of, say, someone's decline into Alzheimer's disease if we made a universal option available of publicly funded cryopreservation.
Yes. Well, whenever you say publicly funded, you're going to get into controversy with certain people because what does that mean? Where do you get the money for public funding? You get it by taxation, and that is controversial among libertarian-leaning people who are very common in transhumanism and cryonics, and they are common in the Society for Universal Immortalism, too. So would it be reasonable to say that cryonic suspension options ought to be publicly funded? That's a tough issue, and I think I'm going to leave that issue up to the listener to think about, because public funding does involve a certain amount of coercion and so on, you could say. I mean, taxation, what is that? It's something that you have to pay whether you like it or not. And you could always appeal for private funding or donations or whatever. so far, I think cryonics is still considered too much of a fringe movement, and it's too far out for any serious consideration to be given by political by the political process in terms of supporting it by taxpayer funding and so on. It's still too new an idea and has too few adherents and just seems too weird to most people. But as time goes on, that issue might well come up.
I agree, and I don't want to belabor the point anymore. Your answer is very politic, but I think that it certainly will become a public policy issue at a point, and yeah, only a transitional one, because eventually we'll probably be beyond the need for even cryopreservation. But at some point, it will become clear that cryo reanimation is a possibility. And at that point, I think people are going to clamor for this as an option.
Yeah.
And if we're already paying, for people to be maintained on machines as they slowly die for 10 or 15 years, people are going to say, well, just freeze me and wake me up later when you get it all fixed.
That's certainly true. And actually, in cryonics, we wish that the public attitude was more favorable right now, because we could, in many cases, improve the quality of a suspension if it could be started a little earlier.
Well, let's give people, as a closing here, some of the contact information for Alcor and for the Society. Alcor is at alcor.org.
That's correct. And the Society is, it's a mouthful, but listen carefully and it should be clear, universalimmortalism.org. All of that, just one word spelled just like it sounds, universalimmortalism.org.
And if you contact, and in order to be a member of universalimmortalism.org, a dues-paying member, you also have to be a member of either Alcor or some other cryo organization.
You need to be signed up for cryonics, and I would say presently we don't have a requirement about paying dues, but you have to have cryonics arrangements.
I've been speaking with Mike Perry. He's a patient care assistant for the Alcor Foundation that freezes and hopes to reanimate people, lives out in Scottsdale, Arizona. He's the president for the Society for Universal Immortalism and the author of Forever for All, Moral Philosophy, Cryonics, and the Scientific Prospects for Immortality. And I want to thank you again.
You're welcome, Jim. It was a pleasure talking to you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com, or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.